international and moral principles, and is committing inhumane crimes in Gaza to cover up for its internal problems. And Israeli airstrikes and artillery fire killed more women and children across Gaza as the death toll from the regime's campaign of genocide approaches 33,000. And our leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says this year's International Goods Day will be a global uproar against the Zionist regime, in which people in non-Muslim countries will also participate. In a meeting with heads of the three branches of the government, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said the Israeli regime will continue to be the losing party in Gaza. He added, the regime's recent crimes against Iranian military advisors in Syria will not save it from defeat. He also stressed the Israeli regime will be punished for that aggression. Now, international condemnation followed the Israeli airstrike on Iran's consulate in the Syrian capital. The European Union was the latest to join calls to condemn the attack after multiple countries, including Iraq, Venezuela, Oman, Qatar, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, China, and Russia, all denounced the Israeli aggression as unacceptable. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister says the recent Israeli terrorist attack on the country's diplomatic missions in Syria violates international principles on immunity of diplomats and diplomatic missions. Hossein Amir Abdullahian was speaking on a phone call with the European Union foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell. He calling on the bloc to condemn the attack in the strongest terms. He asked how EU will react if a similar attack had hit a Western embassy in Ukraine. Iran's top diplomat criticized EU for urging Iran to show self-restraint while Israel continues violating all international laws. Touching on ongoing Israeli genocide in Gaza, Amir Abdullahian said regime's crimes continue with full U.S. support, adding that U.S. will directly be responsible for any escalation of tensions in the region if it does not stop the Israeli regime's war crimes. Borrell, for his part, said the EU believes Israel's attack on the Iranian embassy in Syria is at odds with efforts made to reduce regional tensions. Meanwhile, the Syrian government has held a ceremony in Damascus to pay homage to the seven Iranian military advisors killed in that deadly Monday Israeli attack on the Iranian consular section of its embassy in Syria.
This is a first of its kind in Syria to commemorate the funeral of the martyrs. This is the second martyr here. The first one were all the martyrs now. One, two, three martyrs now heading to the ambulances, which will after this go to Sayyida Zainab Shrine to be heading to Iran later. We were at the embassy where we also met several governmental party members, prominent party members, who came to pay their respects and give condolences to the Iranian people, to the Republic, to the Islamic Republic of Iran, for the martyrs of the IRGC. We have met with also the representative of Al-Nujaba movement. He said that the Islamic resistance in Iraq will take it personally and respond to this attack. They started already with this response to the to this treacherous attack. The ceremony now begun. We are here currently bidding farewell to these martyrs who gave their lives while wearing their military uniform, defending Syria against terrorism, supporting the resistance, giving aid to the resistance in Gaza.
The European Union's joined, of course, the condemnation against Israel's recent deadly airstrikes on the Iranian embassy in Syria. EU says the diplomatic and consular premises and personnel must be protected in all cases and circumstances. In a social media post, Peter Ostano, a spokesperson for the European Commission, called on regional countries to show utmost restraint. On Monday, Israeli warplanes bombed a consular section of the Iranian embassy in Damascus. That attack killed two Iranian senior military commanders who are on an advisory mission to Syria, along with five accompanying officers. Prior to International Quds Day, a pro-Palestinian event called Quds Pulpit has been held simultaneously in Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, Yemen, and Syria. A number of resistance front leaders addressed this event. Have a listen.
On the blessed Al-Quds Day, I salute all the mujahideen and all the great fighters from amongst our people, those who have humiliated the forces of the Zionist enemy and have broken its awe and its hubris and continue to do so. I also bow down to our people in Gaza. We step forward to provide it with support as much as we can, and we are ongoingly trying to advance our missile and naval capabilities to contribute further in supporting and standing with the Palestinian people and also to attack the Israeli enemy. The Palestinian oppressed people are suffering from oppression and are suffering from killing and kidnapping and torture and demolishing of homes and also demolishing of agricultural lands. The Zionist aggression against our people and its sanctities would not have continued and reached this level of brutality were it not for the American cover provided, but rather effective American participation in the crimes of this occupation, and were it not for the American direct participation in the aggression against our people by providing the Zionist occupation with thousands of tons of lethal weapons and bombs and missiles. What is taking place today in Gaza is that the Zionist entity is not committing to any of the humanitarian and legal and international principles, and it commits brutal crimes, inhumane crimes to cover up for its weaknesses internally. And today, the Palestinian cause and the cause of Gaza separates between two, between commitment and the abandonment or carelessness towards humanitarian principles. Today, the Iraqi government, the honorable Iraqi government, and the Iraqi people and the Islamic resistance, they are more insisting on the withdrawal of these troops and achieving complete national sovereignty to our people in Gaza and in Palestine. What is important, my dear colleagues, is that we must take action for us to come out, God willing, from this battle, to come out victorious with our heads high, successful, and for defeat to be dealt to the enemy and to all those who stand behind this enemy.
Iranian security forces have foiled two simultaneous terrorist attacks in southeastern province of Sistan and Balochistan. The locals said the attacks hit two police and military posts in cities of Rosk and Chabahar. According to local officials, a number of terrorists affiliated with Pakistan-based Jaish-ul-Ad terror outfit have been killed or wounded in the attacks. They said three Iranian security forces also lost their lives. And at this point, there's been no more details out yet. Jaish-ul-Ad terror group, though, has conducted a number of similar attacks in recent months, some of them deadly. Group claimed responsibility for an attack back in December on a police station in the city of Rosk as well, which left 11 police officers dead. And then on January 10th, another attack in the same city on a police station left one policeman dead. Days after that attack, Iran launched simultaneous drone and missile strikes on Jaish-ul-Ad positions in Pakistan, killing and injuring a number of the terrorists. Israeli regime is pressing ahead with its relentless airstrikes and artillery shelling of the besieged Gaza Strip nearly 6 months into its genocidal war. Regime's latest bombing of a home in the southern city of Rafah left four people dead, including two infants. Elsewhere in Rafah, several Palestinians were killed and wounded after Israeli jets targeted another residential building. A series of Israeli raids left at least two Palestinians dead and over a dozen wounded in the Al-Maghazi refugee camp in central Gaza. In Deir al-Balah, several people were killed and dozens injured as a result of the regime's raids. Nearly 32,980 people have so far been killed and over 75,500 others injured since Israel began its onslaught on Gaza in early October. Moti Abu Musabe joined us earlier from central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah, and he said it's another tough night for Palestinians in Gaza.
Yes, actually, the Israeli warplanes intensified their airstrikes and attacks against Deir al-Balah city, particularly over the last couple of moments, at least four Palestinian residential buildings were targeted and destroyed by those relentless airstrikes. In addition to that, the Israeli artillery maintained shelling the eastern part of the city, while when it comes to al-Nusrat refugee camp and the northern part of al-Nusrat refugee camp, it was also hit by more Israeli airstrikes. Another residential building was destroyed over the last moments, in addition to the Israeli artillery that was maintained against the northern part of that refugee camp, particularly Al-Zahra neighborhood, while Arborej refugee camp in the central area as well was targeted and hit relentlessly over the last couple of moments by the Israeli artillery shelling. Apparently, it's another tough night for the Palestinian civilians here in the central area of Gaza Strip, knowing that this area is completely overwhelmed and overcrowded with displaced Palestinians who have been evacuated from different parts of Gaza City and the northern part of Gaza Strip. While when it comes to the other areas of Gaza Strip, according to the breaking news that came moments ago, that Beit Hanun City is also hit these moments by the Israeli warplanes and the Israeli artillery shelling. So the Israeli warplanes are still decimating Gaza Strip with more airstrikes.
An international rights organization says that Israel uses starvation, restricting aid delivery, killing of hungry individuals as a policy to reinforce the famine in Gaza. EuroMed Human Rights Monitor says as a result of Israel's policy, famine has spread throughout northern Gaza, increasing the number of deaths from starvation, malnutrition, and related illnesses. The report says Israeli policy of deliberate starvation is not only an attempt at ethnic cleansing, but also intended to impose Palestinian expose Palestinian civilians to the risk of actual death. The Rights Monitor concluded collective punishment the Israeli regime has imposed on Gaza is aimed at starving the entire population there, and it urged the international community to make Israel respect international law and halt its ongoing campaign of genocide. The Islamic Resistance in Iraq says it's carried out new strikes against Israeli targets in occupied territories in support of Gazans. The Iraqi Resistance said both operations were carried out using drones. First attack targeted Israel's Ramat David Air Base southeast of the city of Haifa. The second, resistance drones hit a vital target in the city of Ashdod. The Iraqi Resistance said the new operations are in response to the Israeli massacres of Palestinian civilians, including women, children, and the elderly. The group said it will continue its operations against the regime's strongholds. In recent months, the Islamic Resistance in Iraq has carried out a spate of attacks against Israeli targets. It's also hit U.S. military bases in Iraq and Syria in retaliation for Washington's support for Israel's onslaught. International Quds Day is an annual pro-Palestinian event marked on the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan. Day is designated by the founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, back in 1979 in solidarity with Palestinians. People worldwide will mark this year's Quds Day on the coming Friday.
On the last Friday of the holy month, the people will try to reach Al-Quds. People come from here and there and try to climb over the separation walls just to go to Al-Quds and pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. All people sacrifice their souls for the sake of Al-Aqsa Mosque.
The International Quds Day and the protest rallies in the Islamic world came to expose the occupation and that Al-Quds will always be the priority for Palestinians and Muslims. Today, the occupation's mask has fallen and the real face of Israel has appeared. The issue of Palestine has been somehow set aside for years. Today, after what happened in Gaza, it came back to the forefront. We are starting a new era that will be fairer and leading to the end of occupation.
People's movements have always been influential, especially in the situation of Gaza, which we see in people's movements all over the world. Friday protests must be held not only in the Muslim world, but all over the world. And even here in the West Bank, protests must be held, and we, the Palestinians, who are banned from reaching Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa, must go to the streets. The last large protest here in Ramallah was on the 8th of March. Such huge protests must be held in support of Gaza and for defense of the Al-Quds and for Palestine.
The Quds Day is very important to the Islamic world and to us as Palestinians. We must all be united and stand a real stance in the face of the Israeli brutality and the violations against the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We have to do our utmost to travel to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, even if we are banned. We must protest in the centers of the cities. We have to keep calling for ending the genocidal war on Gaza, and we have to defend the Al-Aqsa Mosque with all means possible.
Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime has turned the largest medical facility in the Gaza Strip into a charred wasteland, a slaughterhouse, a cemetery. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, during its two-week siege on Ashifa Hospital, the Zionist regime destroyed all buildings and departments without exception in a clear crime that shames humanity, Gaza's government media office stated. The army withdrew at dawn after facing fierce battles from Palestinian resistance factions. When the families of patients, medical staff, and displaced persons who were trapped inside the hospital and its grounds during Israel's raid and massacre returned to retrieve their loved ones, many found bodies in fragments flattened under bulldozer treads. Children's corpses were discovered burnt beyond recognition. The media office added, inside the complex and its surroundings, the occupation army killed more than 400 martyrs, an attempt to hide its abominable crime by executing hundreds of civilians, the wounded, and the sick within the walls of Ashifa Medical Complex. They covered the bodies with piles of sand, bulldozed them, buried them, and mixed them with the ground of the complex. Moreover, more than 300 prisoners were arrested, while over 100 Palestinian civilians are still missing as a result of the occupation's shocking crime. The Geneva-based Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor stated hundreds of bodies inside Ashrafa complex and in the surrounding area have been found burnt and mutilated, including corpses with their heads and limbs severed. The group called Israel's destruction and slaughter at Ashrafa one of the largest massacres in Palestinian history. During the 14-day raid, the Zionist regime forces carried out summary executions, kidnappings, while forcing medical staff to abandon their patients. The bodies of physicians Ahmad Al-Maghdame, a plastic surgeon, was found alongside his mother, Dr. Yasmin Al-Maghdame, inside Ashrafa Hospital. According to Dr. Ahmad Al-Maghdame's colleague, the British-Palestinian surgeon Ghassan Abu Seteh, they were shot by Israeli regime troops as they tried to flee the hospital. More than 20 patients were found dead in their hospital's beds as a result of the Israeli siege of the complex and the deliberate deprivation by the Zionist regime troops of medical care, food and water, Euromed stated recently. During the siege, Euromed added, Israeli regime forces obstructed the arrival of relief teams and representatives of international organizations to the complex to carry out humanitarian missions. Palestinian resistance forces had engaged in fierce battles with the Zionist regime troops during the raid on Ashrafa. Last week, Euromed Human Rights Monitor documented systematic and horrifying military operations by Israeli regime forces inside and outside the Ashrafa complex. Among these operations, the group explained, were at least 13 executions of Palestinian children between the ages of 4 and 16 years old. Euromed reported, some of the fatal shootings occurred during an Israeli army siege while the victims' families were inside their homes. Others occurred when the victims attempted to escape via routes that the Israeli army had designated as safe after forcibly evacuating them from their homes and places of residence. Euromed stated, Islam Ali Saluha, who lives near Ashrafa, said the Israeli forces killed his two sons, 9-year-old Ali and 6-year-old Saeed, on March 24th, in front of their families and fellow locals. They specifically targeted the children, he said, with live bullets. Saluha told the human rights group that the Israeli regime forces ordered residents of the area to leave. His young sons walked just meters before they were suddenly exposed to intense gunfire, which targeted the two children, Ali and Saeed in particular. The children then fell in front of them, their bodies covered in blood. As family members attempted to pull the two kids off the ground, he said the Israeli forces opened fire on them again, forcing them to leave Ali and Saeed on the ground and to continue walking. The Zionist regime lawmakers and political figures have repeated claims that the hospital complex was used as a Hamas and Islamic Jihad command center. Naftali Bennett, the Zionist regime's former prime minister, called the destruction of Ashrafa an amazing battlefield achievement. Bennett claimed Hamas used the staff and patients as human shields in order to cause maximum civilian casualties as to create more criticism and pressure on Israel, adding that not one civilian was killed, not one. The Zionist regime's military chief of staff, Herzl Halevi, boasted that the army siege of Ashrafa sends a very, very important message here and hospital is not a safe place. Recently, Francesca Albanese, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Palestine, included Israel's crime of medical shielding in her report on the genocide in Gaza. Albanese writes in Anatomy of a Genocide, targeting medical facilities while accusing the enemy of shielding within them had already been employed by Israel as a strategy of medical lawfare in previous wars. In the current assault, Israel has invoked this legal strategy to justify genocide through the complete destruction of life-sustaining infrastructure, a report states. Recently, Albanese called on the International Criminal Court's lead prosecutor, Karim Khan, to take action over the Zionist regime's genocidal campaign. Albanese stated, "This is the greatest moment of truth in the ICC history."
The Israeli aggression against the people of Palestine has a long and tumultuous history, marked by genocide, occupation, and countless human rights violations. The Palestinian struggle to liberate their country stands as one of the most enduring and contentious resistance movements in modern history. At its heart lies the issue of occupation, with Israel's presence in Palestinian territories being a source of deep-seated grievances, violence, and international concern. The roots of the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories can be traced back to the late 19th and early 20th centuries, with the rise of the Zionist movements advocating for the establishment of a so-called Jewish homeland in historical Palestine. The Balfour Declaration of 1917, issued by the British government, lent support to these aspirations, laying the groundwork for the eventual creation of Israel in 1948. The events surrounding the creation of Israel in 1948, known as the Nakba, or the Catastrophe, marked a pivotal moment in the history of the region. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were displaced from their homes and became refugees as a result of the conflict between Israeli and Arab forces. In 1967, Israel launched a strike against Egypt, Jordan, and Syria in what became known as the Six-Day War. Supported by its Western allies, including the United States and Britain, the Israeli regime occupied the West Bank, including East Al-Quds, the Gaza Strip, the Sinai Peninsula, and the Golan Heights. This marked the beginning of Israel's military occupation of Palestinian territories, which continues to this day. Palestinians tried all diplomatic and legal ways to end the Israeli occupation over the past seven decades. In the early 1990s, efforts were made to negotiate a peaceful resolution to allow Palestinians to have their own state. Known as the Oslo Accord, it never put an end to the Israeli aggression, as the regime continued settlement expansion in the occupied territories. There were other deals, including Camp David, which never resulted in peace and only emboldened Israel in its atrocities against Palestinians. Throughout its occupation of Palestinian territories, Israel has committed all kinds of atrocities against Palestinians, including massacres and non-stop human rights abuses, such as land confiscation, home demolitions, arbitrary arrests, and excessive use of force against Palestinian civilians. The Palestinian resistance to the Israeli occupation has taken various forms. It started from peaceful protests to civil disobedience. But with major world powers' unconditional support for Israel, under whose influence even Arab countries started normalizing ties with the regime, Palestinians found no alternative to armed resistance to achieve their rights. Palestinians decided to take up arms and fight for the liberation of their territory, with groups such as Hamas and Islamic Jihad gaining prominence in the popular struggle.
What do you think? Do you advise me to continue as a slave? It's a right which has been granted for us who are living under occupation. That the time the diplomacy and politics fail, it's a right of those people who are living under occupation to defend themselves with all means. The victory has to be snatched, especially when you are facing such extremist, murderous, criminal leadership of your enemy.
On October 7, 2023, the Palestinian resistance fighters launched their biggest operation yet, a massive and deadly response to over 70 years of Israeli atrocities against them. Thousands of rockets fired from Gaza rained down on the occupied territories. The projectiles reached as far north as Tel Aviv and as far east as Al-Quds. Shortly after, Palestinian fighters stormed towns in the south, launching deadly attacks and taking more than 200 captives, including military personnel. The 10-hour Al-Aqsa flood operation dealt a humiliating blow to Israel's much-touted military and intelligence system. Shortly after the operation, the Israeli military launched a massive strike on the besieged Gaza Strip that has killed more than 30,000 people, most of them women and children, so far. The Israeli regime, encouraged by the U.S. and Western allies' support, outlined three major objectives for this onslaught on Gaza.
I have three goals. One goal is to defeat Hamas, utterly defeat and destroy Hamas. The second is to bring back our hostages. And the third is to ensure that we don't have a similar threat in the future from Gaza, and that what happens in Gaza is good for Israel, good for Palestinians, good for the Middle East. And to do that, we need to demilitarize Gaza and de-radicalize Gaza. We cannot have, it mean for the foreseeable future, Israeli overriding military responsibility.
The Israeli regime has not only failed to achieve the goals, but also was forced to negotiate with Hamas on a ceasefire. The failure to achieve these goals has not only exposed the limitations of Israel's military prowess, but has also highlighted the resilience and the determination of Palestinian resistance forces.
There is no doubt that Operation Al-Aqsa Flood represented a success for the resistance movement, a success in carrying out a large-scale operation without the enemy being able to take action preemptively. This operation succeeded in seizing the entire Gaza positions within just hours. This is undoubtedly a great achievement, but here's the question. Was there any expectation for the enemy's reaction? Certainly. It was expected that there would be a reaction, but it is the nature of the occupation. It kills you, seizes your land, arrests you, and imprisons you. For example, in the West Bank in 2022, before the operations, the number of martyrs was about 500. The number of wounded people who were taken to hospitals exceeded 3,000. We are talking about thousands of prisoners. Under this occupation for 75 years, you have two choices. Either you do nothing and it continues to kill you, capture you, and seize your land, or you resist and the enemy will continue the aggression. But the message will be conveyed that the Palestinian people are still adhering to their right to resist, that the enemy is paying a price for the occupation.
Operation Al-Aqsa Flood marked a significant turning point for the Palestinian people, showcasing the harsh reality of Israeli occupation to the world. This operation not only highlighted the plight of Palestinians, but also indicated the power of Palestinian resistance in a coastal territory which has been under siege for some 17 years. Prior to this operation, Arab states were moving towards normalizing ties with Israel, overshadowing the Palestinian cause. However, the Gaza war that ensued, the October 7th operation, has shifted global attention back to the long-standing struggle of Palestinians for freedom over the past 7 decades. It's been a stark reminder of the brutality of the Israeli occupation. Despite Israel's military might and reputation, the war in Gaza has been perceived as a humiliating defeat for Israel on multiple fronts. Public opinion worldwide has increasingly turned against Israel as images of civilian casualties and destruction in Gaza have circulated widely, shedding light on the brutality by Israeli forces, which left no safe zone in Gaza, hitting even hospitals and UN refugee shelters. The October 7th operation stands as a testament to the power of Palestinian resistance, showcasing how a small and determined movement can withstand the might of the Israeli army, backed by the US and other Western countries. This operation highlighted the unwavering resilience of the Palestinian people and emphasized that resistance is not only a means of survival, but also a powerful tool in securing their right to self-determination. The ability of Palestinian fighters to hold their ground against one of the most advanced armies in the world has not only defied expectations, but also exposed the limitations of military might in the face of steadfast resistance. The refusal to surrender in the face of overwhelming odds sends a powerful message that the Palestinian people will not be silenced or oppressed, but will continue to fight for their rights and their dignity.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, what are our intentions in fasting in the holy month of Ramadan? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, dear friends, an honor to be here in the holy month of Ramadan. Alhamdulillah, praise be to Allah that we have been given the life by the Almighty, the generous Allah, to be able to witness another holy month of Ramadan. You know, unfortunately, this holiest of holy months, the best of days and the best of nights, the best of hours, is going by so quickly, and before we know it, it will be the end of the holy month of Ramadan, and we will have lost this beautiful, divine, generous, compassionate companion that we were with for these 29 or 30 days. Really, we pray to the Almighty Allah that He gives us the opportunity and the blessing to be able to witness another holy month of Ramadan, and that way may we succeed, and that may we be able to take advantage of that next holy month of Ramadan, inshallah. So we're talking about niyyah, we're talking about intention. So here, when it comes to our intention in the holy month of Ramadan, of course, this is another one of the fundamental things that we need to get straight. And I guess we could have talked about it in the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, but of course, you know, there were so many other things to talk about, and every single one of them really, you know, had this great value to it, that, well, it's not bad to talk about it at this point in time, right? They say better late than never, right? Even though if it was earlier, perhaps it would have been better. So we're talking about intention and what kind of different intentions we kind of have when it comes to fasting in the holy month of Ramadan, and ideally what should be our, you know, best intention, if you will.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we're talking about intention and our fasting in the holy month of Ramadan. Now, what's really interesting is that, you know, we're always trying to connect this to our Islamic lifestyle. And, well, you know, in the rest of our Islamic lifestyle and in the rest of our Islamic life, the concept of intention and niyyah is, of course, incredibly important, right? In Arabic, before we, you know, do our prayers or our fasting or our hajj or anything for that matter, we say qurbatan ilallah, meaning for the sake of the nearness of the Almighty Allah. And, well, I guess I answered the question, even though I've had a whole bunch of other stuff that I wanted to talk about. So here, some of our intentions usually are in order to gain the reward of Allah that might be manifested in this world or, you know, especially in the next. Or our intention might be to save ourselves from Allah's punishment, again, which can manifest themselves in this world, but most definitely are manifested in the next world. These are, you know, two basic things or two basic intentions. You know, the ultimate intention that we should have, you know, is for the nearness of the Almighty Allah, which that itself is there. But there's a kind of a deeper or more profound intention, and that is to do something for the sake of Allah, because Allah has requested us to do this. And because we are a creation of Allah, then we are duty-bound. It is our responsibility, and honor and nobility dictates that because we are the creations of the Almighty Allah, that we should obey the Creator, you know? And sure, via the obedience of the Creator and via the obedience of the Almighty Allah, we gain nearness to the Almighty Allah. So, you know, let's make sure that in the holy month of Ramadan, you know, our intention is straight, even though all of these intentions are accepted, but some are a little more profound than others.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Cancer, the new trailblazers.
One of the oldest and most widespread diseases in the world, cancer has always existed and is found in all living things, including plants. It was once thought to be related to the humours, to be contagious or viral in origin. Today it is believed that the cause may be genetic. In every age, new weapons have been unsheathed against cancer, but none have succeeded in vanquishing it. And yet scientists are now able to decipher some of its most intricate processes. Could these advances have been misleading? Could they have in fact led the scientific community astray?
It now appears very likely that we got lost in the details. Our focus was wrong. We were looking at the details of the engine in the car when that wasn't really the problem.
We tend to research the details without seeing the big picture. We lose the forest for the trees.
Einstein said, for an idea that people don't think is crazy in the beginning, there is no hope.
The time has come in America when the same kind of concentrated effort that split the atom and took man to the moon should be turned toward conquering this dread disease.
It's now been over 40 years since the war against cancer was declared by one government or another.
La lutte contre le cancer s'est fixée comme objectif.
70% of the cancers that were fatal in the 1950s can now be cured. But such undeniable achievements are, in the end, relatively minimal. In spite of the many billions that have been invested in cancer research in the last half century, mortality rates have not decreased as much as expected. The disease continues to kill 8 million people every year. But how well do we really know this enemy? And to begin with, how do we define it?
When you take these cells from the person and put it in a dish, or from an animal and put it in the dish, the genes are not fixed. They are regulated by context. They are regulated by microenvironment. So that just clarified a lot of things for me, that again, context or microenvironment, and in this case, the architecture of the tissue was very, very important. And once you destroyed the architecture, that in combination with the oncogene could make a tumor.
In a forest, if there's a plant or an animal species that proliferates to the point of destroying the ecosystem, that is literally the equivalent of cancer in the body. Rather than seeing the body as something that functions under the centralized control of our DNA, if we see it as a self-regulating system, like a forest or an ocean, we will then start to look at how the element that is proliferating gets access to nutritional resources and will study the predators. So, for example, if a certain type of rabbit suddenly begins to multiply to the point of destroying the forest, we're not going to say, oh, the rabbit has mutated. We would wonder instead if carrots hadn't become more abundant for some reason, or if some of the other species that would normally compete with the rabbits hadn't disappeared. Or whether the foxes that kept a check on the rabbit population hadn't some kind of problem that year. And so all of a sudden, instead of looking for mutations, you're faced with a more global vision of balances and imbalances.
people like me have argued, instead of looking at all of these changes all the time, the genetic changes and all this bioinformatic analysis and the constant need to sequence, is maybe we should just step back and look at some other ways to think about cancer.
There are various ways of changing tumor metabolism, of improving it. You can do it through your diet, in other words, by reducing the amount of glucose that you consume and by reducing the amount of food that you eat in general. That's one possibility. However, it hasn't really been tested. Many people do it, but to be honest, we have very few of the proper, clear-cut kind of studies that scientists are so fond of. Another way is to work with the kinds of drugs that specifically target those circuits. That's the approach we've chosen because it's easier to study.
There are limitations, though, of the work done in petri dishes and in animals. And in relation to metformin, one of the major concerns is that much of the work has used metformin in concentrations that are unsafe in humans. So it's very difficult to translate much of that work into the clinical setting.
Every year, over 1 million women around the world are diagnosed with breast cancer, and nearly half of them will die from the disease. Yet testing an old medication like metformin, which might prove to be effective, was an uphill battle. It took 10 years for Pamela Goodwin to obtain the funds needed for this study.
When we started the company in 2002, and again, it was based on targeting this unique metabolic properties of cancer cells, we were probably one of maybe 20 or 40 people that we spoke with who were even aware of Otto Warburg. And occasionally we would meet with potential investors who were older, guys in their 60s and 70s, who when we described what we were doing, they would say, oh, you're targeting the Warburg effect. The idea is that if you can develop an effective therapy that really targets the Warburg effect, you may have a much broader therapeutic that would treat a much wider variety of cancers than would be the case with these molecularly targeted approaches.
Threshold Pharmaceuticals is testing a new drug called TH302 in several countries. In Germany, oncologist Peter Hohenberger is using it on 10 patients who have advanced stage cancer with disseminated tumors. The aim of the trial is to evaluate the effectiveness of combining TH302 with other treatments.
In a therapeutic study, what we want to find out is how effective the treatment is. This can be measured by the fact that the tumors are shrinking, and so that's a positive sign. Our primary goal, however, is to extend the life of our patients. Of course, it takes a long time to develop a drug that we can then prescribe for our patients. It's a process that often takes 4 or 5 years. Before we can use a drug, all of the relevant studies have to be conducted in order to prove that it actually offers something more. For our patients, of course, the procedure is too long.
Since it takes such a long time to get a new drug out and onto the market, many patients will never get the opportunity to try a new treatment, even if it has a good chance of prolonging their lives.
The time frame for conventional standardized clinical trials does not match the time frame of someone diagnosed with cancer, who is in a hurry, and that's understandable.
Since 2009, Dr. Lauren Schwartz has been advocating the idea that a combination of drugs, including metformin, which is already on the market for other diseases, could act on cell metabolism. Tests carried out on mice have indeed been very encouraging. Such drugs are inexpensive, their side effects are already known, and combining them makes them more effective. However, in spite of his repeated requests, he has been unable to obtain the authorization and the funding needed to conduct clinical trials on patients.
Everything we've done has been published. We've had numerous articles in well-known international reviews. And yet there has been absolutely no response. It got to the point that I decided I had to write a book about what I was thinking. And that's when the patients started coming to me. And since those who contacted me knew they had very little time left, I felt I had to inform them of what I thought had a chance of helping them.
Some of the members of the association Facing Cancer Together in the French city of Nantes have decided to try this experimental treatment. The
trials we've conducted come under the heading of compassionate use. Physicians are torn between two obligations, between two laws. On the one hand, trials that are extremely regulated, and on the other, assisting a person in danger. We're authorized to prescribe treatment when it concerns people who are in danger.
Is the treatment prescribed by Dr. Schwartz the miracle we've all been waiting for? He himself refrains from drawing conclusions with regard to a possible or permanent cure.
So far, we've treated, both myself and other people, over 100 patients. And several articles have been published that suggest, and I think the term suggest is the appropriate term, that suggests that we are able to slow down the progression of the disease. In certain cases, we've seen a decrease in the number of tumor markers. Other cases could be called miracles. In the majority of cases, unfortunately, the effect is temporary, and I don't understand why it's only temporary. In other words, they improve, and then afterwards they relapse. But even if we were able to make just a tiny breakthrough, it may not be enough for the patients under my care, but it's still pretty good. Of course, what's also important is to take what we already have, which is far from being perfect, and try to improve it. Combining it with chemotherapy would probably be a good thing, and it's likely there are other agents that could be introduced. At any rate, it's quite clear that we only have a part of the picture.
But I think that the permanent eradication of cancer is unlikely. I recognize this is not going to be a popular view, but it's a realistic view. My goal would be to reduce the incidence as much as we can. And I think it will be important that we manage cancer using agents that are the least toxic that we can use, and that will prolong life as long as possible.
Whether there are new drugs or old drugs, we still don't know how effective they will be. Will the metabolic approach run into the same limitations as the other cancer treatments?
We can't stay up on